May it please the court, this case is here for the second time, this time on a direct appeal by the plaintiff from a grant of summary judgment to the defendant. That grant of summary judgment was based exclusively on a little-known federal statute called the Paul D. Coverdale Teacher Protection Act of 2001. This federal statute basically immunizes all teachers and school administrators throughout the country from any negligence suits. The statute not only covers public schools, it covers private schools, parochial schools, and even home schools. This statute did not have any funding as part of it. It was just a tort reform piece of legislation. But this Coverdale Act was also passed along with a larger piece of federal legislation called the No Child Left Behind Act. The No Child Left Behind Act did have federal funding, but it was directed toward poor schools to improve their academic standards. If you look carefully, there is no provision in the No Child Left Behind Act that references the Coverdale Act, and there's no provision in the Coverdale Act that references the No Child Left Behind Act. This court has got to decide whether or not Congress can directly regulate a non-recipient of federal funds under the spending clause of the U.S. Constitution. The spending clause, as you well know, the spending clause power is a very narrow power. It's not like commerce clause power. It basically provides that in return for federal funds, the recipients of those funds agree to federally imposed conditions. A good example would be, say, Title IX funding. Here's where Congress sends millions of dollars to state universities or even private universities, and in return they say you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. That's an example of spending clause power. In this case, the Coverdale Act directly regulates third persons who are not the recipients of federal funds.
What is your definition of regulate?
Impose conditions on their conduct and on their rights. The Coverdale Act regulates Missouri courts and its litigants. Missouri courts and their litigants don't get any money under the No Child Left Behind Act. The only people that get money under that act are poor public schools, and they're not even part of the what's the basis of the Coverdale Act.
Well, doesn't the act allow state legislatures to determine whether or not it controls or not?
Yes, you're right that the Coverdale Act has a precondition that it has to be actually part of a No Child Left Behind Act. A state has to say, we will accept your funds, and then when we do so, we agree to these conditions. The problem is that the Congress has never had the power to, under the spending clause, to directly regulate a non-recipient of federal funds. There is no case that says that Congress has that power, and that is what this statute does. The most direct case you can find to support the lack of constitutionality of this statute is actually a case cited by the United States in their brief, and also I cited it in my reply brief. It's called Sabree versus United States. This was a case involving a federal bribery statute that made it a crime to bribe an official if that agency got money from the federal government up to $10,000. The Eighth Circuit held that statute, which directly controlled third parties, did not satisfy the spending clause and was not valid under the spending clause, the court went ahead and upheld the constitutionality of the statute under the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution, which was, and then the case was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
But I want to read you. Couldn't Missouri have adopted this statute under 6735B that said that they the subpart shall not apply in any civil action in a state court and chose not to?
I'm not following you, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I'll see if you answer it later.
Okay. Here's what the Eighth Circuit said. It said, we can find, this is on page 17 of my reply brief, we can find no persuasive or authoritative case law supporting the proposition that Congress, acting pursuant to its power to attach conditions to the receipt of federal funds, has the authority to directly regulate the conduct of third parties who are not actually the recipients of the federal funds. Instead, the case law demonstrates that funding conditions statutes may only regulate the recipients of the federal funds.
Well, if the state, by judicial decision, ignores the provisions of the Coverdell provision, does the state then lose money?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
I mean, is there a sanction in the statute?
No.
So it's just put in there to tell the states what to do. The states are recipients of money under the.
That's right, but there's nothing in the statute that says that if this statute is turned, there's no saving clause that says if this statute is unconstitutional, then this will happen. It's just silent. The Coverdell Act really stands independently. If you look at it, it has nothing to do with the No Child Left Behind Act. They don't even reference each other. It's just a piece of tort reform legislation that a bunch of senators decided to throw in because they just don't like teachers and school administrators being sued.
And they don't have the same single subject prohibition that our state constitution has.
That's something they should have. You're correct. It's potpourri legislation. But the bottom line is that SBRE stands 100% in against the constitutionality of this Coverdell Act. It is not supported.
6735B says that the subpart about teacher liability protection, a state can get out from under it if they adopt a particular statute specifically saying they don't want it to apply to them, and Missouri has not adopted such a statute. Why doesn't that avoid any constitutional issues that might otherwise arise as to whether or not the state has authority under the clauses you refer to force this state to follow the provisions of this act? The
question is, did Congress have power under the spending clause when they passed the statute
to force the state to do something? But here it's not forced. If the state could have gotten out from under it and chose not to, they're not being forced to do anything, are they?
Well, it's not. Again, this provision in the statute is just something that if the state wants to, if they want to opt out of that provision.
And they can. So where is the constitutional force down, the unconstitutional forcing under the spending clause of doing something you're saying is unconstitutional?
It's not. There isn't. Okay. There isn't any forcing. The state of Missouri voluntarily agreed to accept No Child Left Behind funds. And when they did, they get the Coverdell Act with it.
Unless they opt out under this provision, which they chose not to opt out of.
Right. But still, it doesn't get away from the question that Congress does not have the authority to pass a statute under the spending clause to affect third parties who are not the recipients of federal funds. This doesn't save that provision.
Is any of this relevant if we should find on the alternative ground that official immunity applies? Do we need to reach any of these issues?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead and tell me why.
Well, first of all, I don't think the court can't even properly address this issue of official immunity because it was an issue that was a denial of a motions for summary judgment that was not proper for appellate review. That issue, according, as I cited in our reply brief, is not even appropriate for this court to address.
But given this court normally doesn't reach constitutional issues, and if it can decide a case on other grounds, on the merits, what would your answer be?
The grounds would be that this statute, even if it's somehow deemed constitutional, that the omissions of Dr. Taylor did not qualify for protection under the statute. This statute has a prerequisite. It's the second prerequisite. It says that in order to get immunity, your conduct has to have complied with state, local laws regarding maintaining order in the classroom.
And opposing counsel, one argument I'd like you to address is they say that's not applying to internal school district regulations. That's referring to state or municipal ordinances and regulations.
Yeah, I think if you look at my reply brief, you'll see that what we're talking about is the application of the Missouri Safe School Act, which was wholly adopted in that regulation. That regulation is the Missouri Safe School Act. There's no dispute in this case that Dr. Taylor had to comply with the pertinent provisions of the Missouri Safe School Act. There's no dispute that he didn't. He did nothing.
Did he have discretion as to how to apply?
How
to apply that?
The law and the regulation is mandatory. It doesn't say you may do this. It says you shall.
What is sufficient to comply with it? Is that a discretionary decision on his part?
No. It says you shall do.
You shall do what?
You shall notify teachers and caseworkers that a student has a criminal record. It says you shall do that. There's no discretion there. It's not like you may do it, you may not. It says you shall do it. It was not done in this case.
Let me ask you one question. I see your time is about up. But Dr. Taylor is the only defendant in this case.
That is correct.
And aren't there? I mean. Question might be, well, aren't there people farther down the food chain that had more direct involvement in this? Because I'm not sure that there's an allegation that he knew about this particular kid or what was going on with this kid. It's all kind of respondeat superior, is it not?
Well, except that Dr. Taylor, his contract and the applicable regulations, it was his duty. He had a duty to execute, implement every regulation adopted by the school board. This regulation, which is basically a restatement of the Missouri State School Act, was something he was obligated, duty-bound, to comply with and satisfy. And
personally,
he did not.
And so he would personally, in the case of every student, it would be his personal obligation to ensure that these regulations would apply for every single student in the district, and he could be sued personally.
I think
he is here for any violation of any regulation.
He had to do it or he had to put in a process to see that it was done. In this case, he did nothing.
And if in their brief they talk about some things he did, and it has to be in the IEP that the person is criminal background and so forth, that I see their argument as being that he thought he was acting within his discretion and how he followed the relevant rules and regulations. You disagree that there's a fact question on that as to whether whether or not he sufficiently complied, and therefore
I think the only fact question on the IEP thing is that what it said is that the Missouri State School Act and this regulation said that any information about dangerous special education students that's in their IEP, that's fancy.
And this wasn't in the IEP, right?
Yeah, and that is correct. But here's the point. There was Dr. Taylor did absolutely nothing to give any guidance to the special ed department to say, you need to put information in their IEPs if you've got a special ed student who's dangerous. And this special ed student was extremely dangerous. Because Dr. Taylor never told his department to put that information in that IEP, it was never put in there. So it is my contention that he violated the spirit and intent of the regulation and law by giving no implementation to it. He never directed the special ed department, you've got to put that information in the IEP.
And that's where my question went about how he implemented the act, wasn't that a discretionary decision on his part as to what he should tell them to put in the IEP, how he should go about carrying it out, and so
on? I don't think there's discretion. You just need to do something. You have to give some direction, and you know, to somebody, to say you need to put that information in the IEP because that's what the law wants. Now, if he did it, it's not. But he did nothing.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Derek Teeter for the respondent. I'd like to pick up on the point Judge Stith raised with regard to Section 6735 of the Coverdale Act. There's actually three instances in this case where the Missouri legislature had the option to receive federal funds and be bound by the Coverdale Act. The first was to receive the funds in the first place. The second was not to take action under 6735 to opt out of the Coverdale Act.
What if the legislature had opted out?
If they had opted out under 6735,
then
those immunity provisions would not apply in the state of Missouri.
But they still got the money.
They could have under the terms of the Act.
They still got the money.
Yes.
Okay.
The third point, Your Honors, is actually the Missouri legislature did pass a statute acceding to the substantive provisions of the Coverdale Act. It's in our appellate appendix at page A11, MoRev Stat 178430. This is the statute through which the Missouri legislature originally accepted federal funds under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. In that statute, the Missouri legislature also said they would accept funds under any other subsequent acts of Congress, which provide federal funds for public schools. In subpart 2 of that statute, 178430, the Missouri legislature said, quote, the benefits of all funds appropriated under the provisions of such acts are accepted as provided in the acts. In other words,
and that was passed before the Coverdale provisions, though.
That's true, Your Honor. But there's no claim made that this statute is unconstitutional under Missouri law. So the Missouri legislature
and they could have under the 6735 adopted a specific statute opting out of this law, but
correct,
chose not to do so.
And they didn't. Mr. Dydell's complaint really is a complaint he needs to make to the Missouri legislature, not to this court. The Missouri legislature is free to change the common law and the statutory law of the state of Missouri. It does so all the time. His client does not have an inherent right to sue my client in negligence. He only has the right to sue my client to the extent the state of Missouri gives him that right. And the state of Missouri, by accepting federal funds, by electing not to opt out, and by passing MoRev Stat 178430, agreed to have its common law changed. The Coverdale Act directly regulates the state of Missouri as a sovereign. And as a consequence of that, individual litigants are collaterally affected. That's what happens when states change their laws. And there's no case that holds that's impermissible. Sabri is inopposite. That case involved an attempt to impose criminal liability on third parties. That's fundamentally different. In any event, Sabri is actually very helpful to our case because it illustrates that whenever you have the exercise of an enumerated federal power, like the spending clause, the necessary and proper clause tags along with it and allows Congress to do additional things that are necessary and proper to the enumerated power. In this case, there's no dispute that Congress had the authority to give money to the states to be used to educate students in schools. As a necessary and proper incident of that power, Congress can pass a law that says that money shouldn't be spent to pay judgments against administrators and teachers who are sued in negligence. That money shouldn't be spent to indemnify them, to pay their attorney's fees. It ought to go to the students. And so Sabri actually provides an entirely additional constitutional basis for this statute, which Mr. Dydell doesn't refute. And remember, Your Honors, it's Mr. Dydell who bears the burden to show this statute is unconstitutional. It's presumed constitutional, unless he shows it clearly and palpably offends the Constitution. And he doesn't even have a case where a statute like this was invalidated. He says the spending clause is a narrow power. It's actually one of the broadest powers Congress has. The last time the Supreme Court invalidated a spending clause exercise of power was in 1936. It hasn't happened in modern time. This statute is clearly constitutional. Incidentally, because it falls within the spending power, there's no 10th Amendment limitation. The Supreme Court said that in Dole. So it applies. And this constitutional challenge is really meritless. Your Honors, the second point I would like to make is that the Coverdell Act does apply on the facts of this case. Now, the argument has now been raised in the reply brief and to the court that this is really about Dr. Taylor's compliance with the Safe Schools Act. That's not the point relied upon. The point relied upon is that Dr. Taylor failed to comply with internal school district policy JGF. That is not a federal, state, or local law. School districts in the state of Missouri do not have the power to enact laws. They have the power to enact internal policies. This internal policy, in any event, does not say what Mr. Dydell says it does. The policy says if a student's individual education plan contains information about his dangerous behavior, then it shall be disclosed to those with a need to know. Note the third person, shall be disclosed. Doesn't impose an obligation on Dr. Taylor specifically, but in any event, it's undisputed that this student's IEP did not contain information about his potentially dangerous behavior.
Was there any obligation placed on Dr. Taylor by the Safe Schools Act?
With respect to the student's IEP?
With respect to dangerous students.
Well,
providing information about dangerous
students.
Not on
the facts of this case, Your Honor. There potentially could be in the right case. There are essentially two provisions of policy JGF that are related to the schools, Safe Schools Act that Mr. Dydell has touched on in his brief. The first relates to the IEP question. That doesn't apply because the IEP didn't contain information about the dangerous student. The reason it didn't is because federal law prohibits such information from being placed in IEPs unless it relates to a student's disability. Federal law exclusively governs what goes into an IEP. That's set forth in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
But opposing counsel argues that he had not just the right but the obligation to put it in the IEP, and that was his failure. Which provision prohibits you? There's a provision of federal law that prohibits him from putting that information in?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We cite it in our brief. It's a rather lengthy statute, but the most pertinent provision is 20 U.S.C. 1414. Why does that prohibit Dr. Taylor from regulating the content of an IEP? Two ways. An IEP is only created by an IEP team. And the only people that can be on an IEP team are special education teachers, classroom teachers, the student's parents, the student, and other people with particular knowledge about that student and the services he or she needs. Dr. Taylor could not force himself on
the IEP.
So
you're not saying that those people, if they had information about criminal conduct, couldn't put it in, but that Dr. Taylor had no input into what was in the IEP?
There's a second provision of the IDEA, Your Honor, and that is the provision that regulates what actually goes into an IEP.
Okay.
And the content of an IEP is always targeted at providing educational services related to the student's disability. So you don't put information in an IEP under federal law that's unrelated to their disability. The federal law explicitly enumerates what goes into an IEP.
You're not saying that the school district couldn't take his criminal history into consideration in deciding placement, but that they wouldn't do it through the IEP. There would have to be way you can protect students in the schools. I mean, we certainly do that.
We do, but federal law actually does limit the extent to which a special education student's criminal background can be used to force him into an alternative school, because the federal law requires that in all cases where it's possible, a student shall be placed in the least restrictive environment, which means their home school. They can't be segregated unilaterally into alternative schools by the administration just because they have one prior violent incident. That would be illegal under federal law. So I think there is no obligation on Dr. Taylor's part with respect to that. The second component of Safe Schools and Policy JGF is this notion that Dr. Taylor has a unilateral duty to report any criminal conduct of a student. That's not how the policy reads. It says the superintendent or his designee shall disclose certain crimes that are reported to the school district. And it's undisputed in this case, and the court can read page 304 of the legal file, Dr. Taylor delegated that reporting responsibility to the Student Discipline Office and the Office of Legal Counsel. Now, later on in his deposition, Dr. Taylor was asked a global question, who's responsible for implementing the Safe Schools Act? And he says, we all are. There are many departments. And that's true. Dr. Taylor, for example, had the obligation to delegate responsibility for reporting. But to the specific reporting duty, it clearly was delegated. And that's permissible. Judge Stith, you also pointed...
Watching your time, you have a co-counsel you're splitting your time with?
Yes, and I'm going to split 5 minutes. Thank you. The final point I would make, Judge Stith, official immunity is an alternative basis to affirm. This court can affirm the grant of summary judgment on any basis that is present in the record, regardless of whether it was the one relied upon by the circuit court. In this case, official immunity was raised in the motion that was granted by the circuit court. That motion was granted in a summary one-page order that did not limit its application to simply the Coverdale Act theory. Therefore, it's presumed to actually have ruled on official immunity. The cases that Mr. Dydell cites that say you can't review denial of a summary judgment motion are when a defendant loses summary judgment, then loses at trial, and attempts to appeal the denial of his earlier summary judgment motion. That's not this case. I cede my remaining time to counsel for the United States.
May it please the court, Elisa Klein for the United States. I'd just like to briefly clarify the relationship between the Coverdell provisions and No Child Left Behind as a whole, in particular the reference to the single subject legislation. No Child Left Behind as a whole, the federal government gives billions of dollars to the states each year to assist in the education of elementary and secondary school children. There are lots of conditions that are attached to those funds, and many have consequences for third parties, students like Mr. Dydell, and teachers. Students are subject to testing. Teachers have to meet certain qualifications. They have to have a bachelor's degree and subject matter competence in the subjects in which they teach. They also, teachers receive certain protections. And here, in particular, under Coverdell, there is a limited protection from certain forms of lawsuits by students under circumstances set out in the statute. And the statute makes explicit that these Coverdell Act protections apply only to states that receive funds under this chapter, which is No Child Left Behind as a whole, and shall apply to such a state as a condition of receiving such funds. These provisions, the Coverdell provisions, are unusual because a state may also actually opt out, as was being discussed, of the Coverdell Act protections if the state chooses. Generally, that's not true. A state can opt out of the testing or teacher qualification or other conditions. But in this respect, what we have is a longstanding Missouri statute that my colleague cited. It's at page 11 of his appendix, in which the state of Missouri, the legislature, explicitly said, we accept all both existing conditions on federal education funds and any subsequent conditions in subsequent federal legislation. You know, they are accepted as provided in those acts. So we don't have a conflict with Missouri law here. If we did, the state law would be preempted. But here,
so this is in the nature of an express preemption clause. And the express preemption clause says you get to decide. On this little issue, if you don't want the tort reform part of No Child Left Behind, you can opt out. But if you don't say anything, it's presumed you stayed in.
Exactly. So here we don't even need to reach a question of preemption, both because we have the longstanding Missouri statute and an ability if the legislature chooses to opt out.
Well, it might be an entirely different question to ask whether the legislature can delegate its lawmaking authority to Congress.
Well, again, Your Honor, this is moving to the broader question. It is common for conditions on federal funds to preempt state law. So if you actually had a conflict, and these are the Supreme Court's decisions in Blum versus Bacon and Philpott and various, you know, spending clause programs, where there was a conflict between the condition on federal funds and the state law, the Supreme Court held by operation of the Supremacy Clause, the state law is preempted. Our point is more modest here because we don't actually perceive a conflict. We don't have any grievance with Missouri, unlike in some of those cases where the state was administering a program in which it got federal funds in a way that was inconsistent with the requirements of the federal statute. And again, just finally to emphasize, Mr. Dynell is not being regulated as that term is ordinarily used. This is actually an easier case than Sabri. Sabri, the United States, you know, there were federal funds given to state and local governments, and a consequence was that the United States could bring a federal criminal prosecution against Mr. Sabri, a private individual, because he attempted to bribe a local official. So that's why the necessary and proper power was invoked in Sabri, because it was a direct federal prosecution of a private individual. Here, although the necessary and proper power is always available, there's no need to invoke it because it's just a consequence of accepting the funds and not opting out. There's a limited preemption of state tort law. Unless the court has questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
I just want to make one point on the constitutionality. The fact that there is a provision for states to opt out of Coverdale doesn't save the or get away from the fact that this act directly regulates non-recipients of federal funds, and that is not allowed under the spending clause. What Congress could have done to maybe make it constitutional was to say, here is what we'll give you this money if you will pass legislation to regulate your residents, and that might be constitutional. That's what happened in South Dakota versus Dole. The Treasury, the Secretary said, we're going to give you highway funds, but you've got to change your laws, your drinking laws first to change your drinking age to 21. Now, Congress could not change that law directly like it did in Coverdale. They knew it. So they said, we'll give you the money, but you've got to regulate your own people because we can't do that constitutionally. In Coverdale, they said, forget that. We don't care about the Constitution. We're just going to go ahead and regulate them directly anyway. Okay. My opposing counsel is incorrect in saying that there is federal law that prohibits putting information in an IEP about dangerous special students. There is nothing cited in his brief to that effect. What Mr. Dieter is just talking about is information about placing a special ed student. This case has nothing to do with placing a special education student. If you will look at the appendix of my opening brief, it'll show you the two claims that we are making in this case. They have nothing to do with placement. What they have to do is with the failure to implement the Missouri Safe School Act as implemented in the two regulations. That's what the claims are. There are no claims.
Your U.S. Opponent mentions Philpott. In Philpott, the Social Security checks could not be garnished. That's a law by the United States government. The banks are not receiving any federal money. The garnishers are not receiving any money. But you cannot garnish Social Security checks if they're separated. How is that not the plot? I mean, the difference
there is that the recipients of the federal money, the Social Security checks, it came with a condition. It's like a lien on it. It said, we're going to give you this money, and nobody can lien that money for various things. And so what Congress is doing is they're still controlling the recipients. They're putting conditions on which that money is being received. In this case, Mr. Didale didn't get any money. The Missouri courts didn't get any money. And they're being regulated. They're taking away Didale's common law rights of action. And they're telling Missouri, they're saying, we're going to change your substantive law and your procedural law. And finally, I want to make one other point that the negligence allegations are set forth in the appendix at A11, and the reason for that is that was the proposed verdict directing instruction when we were getting close to setting this case for trial. So that's really what our claims are. Those are the claims. They are set forth at A11 in our opening brief. And finally, there is not one case that I could locate where the U.S. Supreme Court has ever upheld a direct regulation of individuals and institutions that are non-recipients of the spending clause. There just aren't any. And they didn't cite any.
Did you find any cases that held the Coverdale Act unconstitutional?
It's never been addressed. It's only been cited in like four cases in since its existence, and they didn't locate it until 8 years after it was passed, and then raised it, you know, a month before this case was getting ready for trial. It's never, the constitutionality has never been raised. Most attorneys aren't even aware of it, and they weren't aware of it until 8 years after it was passed.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. The case is taken under submission.